now entering Pacific Noise Weird. Coming at you live from CITR 109 FM. We're broadcasting from UBC on the traditional, ancestral, and unceded lands of the Musqueam people, bringing you the latest, greatest, and weirdest noises coming right out of the Pacific Northwest. Pull up a chair, turn out the lights, and let the noise take you away. You beautiful weirdos out there. We've got a bit of a special episode today. I've got in the studio with me Jesse Gander, and long-time, medium-time, and short-time listeners will know that name. Jesse Gander, would you like to introduce yourself?
Hello, I'm Jesse Gander, and I'm a recording engineer in Vancouver, British Columbia.
All right. Tell me a little bit about what you do as a recording engineer.
Well, what I do is I run a studio in East Vancouver called Rain City Recorders, which is a studio that we've been operating in different capacities for about, at least 10 years, but I've been recording bands in Vancouver for almost 30 years. So, started when I was extremely young, started recording bands when I was 14 years old, and... and now I'm 44 years old.
So yeah. Tell me, how did you get into music? Like, what got you in the field in the first place?
Well, what got me into music was definitely, you know, my parents being big music lovers, and you know, being also sort of audiophiles in a way as well. They always had a, you know, a pretty nice stereo and a big record collection, and went to lots of shows and stuff like that. So. They were always into alternative music and different things like that. And, I just grew up in a house with a lot of music being played, and being played at pretty loud and clear volumes. And that kind of, I guess, was initially what got me interested in sound or thinking about it. But what really got me into recording was recording with my own band when I was very, very young. When I was 12 or 13 years old, I started... started recording in recording studios with the music I made, and that led me into an interest in recording other people as well.
That's super awesome, and I can relate to having a parent who's really into very crisp audio.
Oh, cool.
So how did you start a studio? Tell me about that.
Well, yeah, I've always worked at my own studio. I've never had a job per se working at someone else's studio, for example. I started recording bands in about 1994. At that time, computers really weren't fast enough to record bands yet, so they were close, but it was still sort of around the corner, right? So I started on 4-track cassette, a Yamaha 4-track cassette recorder that I got when I was around 14 years old. And, all the other local bands in my high school and stuff like that, I'd go to their house on weekends. And I'd also promote all-ages shows back in those days in my neighborhood, punk rock shows, the local community centers and stuff. And, because I had some microphones, I naturally do live sound as well. And then, of course, because I did a little live sound, I had a little 4-channel mixer as well, so I could mix, 4 vocals. I just sort of working summer jobs and stuff like that. I was always acquiring more... microphones and cables and stands and all the kind of necessary stuff to make a recording, and just kept recording more and more of my kind of high school friends' bands, and then because I was doing live sound for a lot of other bands from East Vancouver and other neighborhoods, they started asking me to come to their house and record them too. So I started spending my weekends in in East Van recording the punk bands that were around in those days. Yeah.
All right, that's super cool. This is a music scene that I've been part of since, after you got into it. So,
yeah.
I definitely have been surrounded by the music that you've been working on. So it's really awesome to, hear about the backstory. What's your favorite piece of equipment to work on with over the years?
Over the years, it's. I mean, there's definitely a few microphones that I absolutely love. That, you know, when I put them in front of any kind of musician, I just am so pleased with how they sound. But you know, at the end of the day, my favorite piece of equipment to work with is honestly my DAW. You know, just using Pro Tools. I loved recording to tape back when I did, and I still do sometimes. I don't just work on hi-fi recordings. I do lo-fi shit too, right? I do four-track cassette recordings. You know, I record onto half-inch eight-track tape too. But you know, just honestly, where I feel comfortable is Pro Tools. I've been using that program for 20 years, you know, so I know it like the back of my hand. And you know, when it screws up, I know why. I feel like it's anything I can imagine I could make happen. So you know, it's not a microphone, it doesn't record without one, but for me, like a big part of my job is actually mixing. So for me, if I only had one tool to mix with, it would be Pro Tools. But you could exchange that with whatever, you know, program you like. There's plenty of free programs, or, you know, a lot of people use Logic these days for composition and stuff. So it doesn't have to be that one. That's just the one that I know.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you sound like a bit of an early adopter. 2002 is an early era for the DAW.
Totally, yeah. Like, for me, as soon as... Pretty much like there was sort of a moment where that technology became sort of affordable to do on a multi-track level. By that, I mean like a 24-track recording, which was really kind of like when the Mac G4 came out. It came out the same time as the Pro Tools 001 interface, which was, you know, about $1,500, which was a lot of money to me at the time. These days, there's so many more affordable options. But at that time, you know, for $1,500, that you never heard of being able to make a, you know, a 16-track live off the floor recording of a band, especially at a good quality, like 24 bits. That never really been possible before without spending tens of thousands of dollars. Like, you used to be able to buy a Pro Tools card-based system that was, you know, very expensive, right? But yeah, this was like, so I actually got a small loan to pay for, to get the $1,500 for that, and a little bit of money for the new Mac, which of course always kind of expensive too. And yeah, with that, I all of a sudden had the ability to record 16 tracks and mix 24. So that is when I learned how to use a DAW, and that is when I sort of, I mean, some people may say that's a consumer quality system, but for me, that was the first time I'd ever had professional recording available to me, you know, any time of the week. And my older brothers had both moved out, they'd gone off to university or trade school, so I had both use of their bedrooms in my parents' basement, and I started recording hardcore and punk bands and hip-hop in my parents' basement, turning their bedrooms into isolation booths. Yeah, and they put up with it.
I mean, if they sound like the kind of parents who would.
Well, they deserved it because they made me listen to loud music that I thought was annoying when I was a child. So they deserved it.
It's payback.
Mm-hmm, payback, exactly.
Discorder Magazine has been supporting local music for over 30 years. Thanks to the long-term support of the Rickshaw Theater, Discorder lives. Favorite bands are playing at the Rickshaw Theater. Check out their calendar just behind the cover of Discorder Magazine or at rickshawtheater.com.
So, what do you think defines your sound as an engineer? Like, what's your touch?
Well, I mean, I'll leave that in the ear of the beholder, but I guess what people tell me is, like, I mean, to me, I try to make every recording different, but I think what I'm known for is being able to record a band and make it sound real and make it sound like they would live, hopefully. But an enhanced version of that. Like, I am very comfortable and sort of specialize in recording bands live off the floor. That's something I don't need to overdub everything and nitpick everything that way. But again, because I've been using Pro Tools for a long time, a lot of my recordings are live off the floor recordings that I've you know, done edits to, you know, remove the boo-boos that don't contribute to the you know, performance, in my opinion. So that's a big one for me, is just like making records that are like a band live, but in an enhanced version of what they would be live, like, or maybe live but at their tightest show ever, you know, kind of thing. That's one of them. I'm also pretty known for my vocal coaching just because I've always been a singer. So, you know, a lot of people ask me to help them record their vocals because I just know how to coach them and make them feel on pitch. And, you know, or people that are maybe insecure singing, like people that have never sang in a studio before or haven't done so in any great detail before. I try to make them, you know, try to make them feel relaxed and have fun with the process, but also make sure it's, you know, really tight and something that they can hopefully be proud of as time goes by, right? So that's something that I take a lot of pride in, I guess.
Absolutely, absolutely. Mm-hmm. What's your, like, current track for your business? Like, what are you working on right now?
Right now I'm working on a few things. Today I'm mixing a band from, it's half from Calgary, half from here, called Noka Project. And they are a very, very cool band. Sort of like, to me, it's sort of like a, sort of a modern sort of take on folk, like a pop folk kind of project. I was mixing a band from Ottawa yesterday called Sedatives, which is like old school punk. Yeah, I'll be working on some of the, I mean, I have a lot of records coming out this year that I just finished. A band from Belgium called Brutus that I recorded in Belgium in January. A new White Lung record is coming out, and they're kind of one of the bands I'm sort of known for working with. So a band I love. And next week it's a band from Calgary, like a kind of a crust punk band called Death Knell are coming in to record. Going to do a jazz record or sort of a classical meets avant-garde jazz record in August, a woman named Alicia Hansen. So, yeah, and I've got a couple other things as well. There's a couple of projects I'm working on that haven't been announced yet as well, so I gotta keep them tight-lipped so I don't spoil the surprise.
Absolutely. Well, I'm looking forward to having them all on the radio.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Lots of good stuff. We have... We're quite busy these days at the studio, which is good. Ironically, the pandemic almost made us busier because so few bands were touring that a lot of those bands were taking the opportunity to write. And after you write the song, well, then you got to record the song. So a lot of bands have sort of strategized with inconsistent touring, which is, you know, thankfully now picking up a little bit for them, but there's still, of course, bumps in the road. A lot of those bands have chosen to record with me this year, so I'm actually... booked quite far in advance, which is great for job security as a self-employed guy.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Can't complain about more business.
No, exactly. But there's only so many hours in the day, and you have to rest your ears, too. I got to ride my bike as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have definitely noticed a severe uptick in the amount of music, and like especially self-published music.
Yeah.
A lot of bands that I've known to be doing like traditional recording are like, I recorded this all in my bedroom because I couldn't leave it. And I'm like, oh. I'm not going to complain about content, but hoo boy.
Oh, man, so much. I mean, I think it actually might be number one on CITR right now. Kelarissa, her new record, she recorded that, in the peak of the pandemic. And I mixed that record, actually. So, and I know CITR has been playing that record a lot out on Mint Records, which is an amazing electronic pop record. For anybody who hasn't heard it, they should listen to it. So, yeah, that's a perfect example of a gig that came to me because... You know, Larissa had been recording all that music at home, and she'd actually done a really, really nice job of it. Actually, probably a pretty good tip could be shared for the home recordist. You know, she's made a lot of albums before, so she has a certain, you know, quality in mind that she's hoping to achieve. And she used, I think she's Logic, but she might have even used GarageBand. I'm not sure about that. She might have switched to Logic for the project, you know, for whatever reason. But what she did is she actually went down to Long McQuaid and she rented one really great microphone. Rented one Neumann microphone for a month or whatever, you know, spend $200 or something. And so her vocals sound crystal clear. You know, she rented a Neumann U87. So, yeah, it's a home recording, but, you know, done at a very, very professional level, you know, because the microphone, that's it makes a big difference. Especially in the case of her, too, where she's a classically trained singer and has a really, you know, beautiful ethereal voice. Some people sound great through a cheap mic, but some people sound great through an expensive mic. And I think she's the kind of singer, she probably sounds pretty good through both, but she sounds extra good through the expensive mic. So that's a good example of how people, if they're committed to making a record at home and can't afford to buy a Neumann because they're very expensive, you know, you can rent one for a short period of time and do your vocals then, and you know, you can sound very, very, very much like you did in a studio.
Yeah. So microphone, absolute most important piece of equipment, hey?
Well, the musician's the most important, and their instrument, you know, so we won't take any credit away from them. you know, if you have a great musician, any mic will sound good. But, you know, if you're trying to make it sound as good as possible, then the microphone is the next step. You know, I feel like in the chain of sound quality, it's the musician and then their instrument. And then after that, it's the microphone. And then probably after that, it's the mic preamp. And after that would be the recording. But the software all sounds the same, really. Like if you're recording Logic or Pro Tools or Cubase or whatever you have available to you, you know, like Adobe has the free one as well, which a lot of people use. Can't really name it right now, but Audacity. All those sound the same. So really, it's about the sound. It's about the source that you get into the DAW of your choice or tape. And microphone is what turns the sound into electricity, which is ultimately what you're trying to capture. Mm-hmm. And of course, your computer turns the electricity into data, which is an important part of it too. But yeah. Not as important as initially turning that sound into electricity. That's more important than what converts the electricity into data.
Yeah. My first ever recorded song was done on a Future Shop brand Nikea $20, was 7mm jack sort of situation. It was awful, and it sounded bad, and we piped it directly into
SoundCloud?
No, not SoundCloud. This was back in 2007.
Oh, yeah.
Rock Band?
Something like that.
It was an old program off of a Mac, and we recorded it in my friend's attic, and it sounded awful.
Yeah.
it was fun, though.
Yeah. But it's super fun. I think my first recording was we had an old cheap cassette deck around my band's jam space when we were kids, and we found out that I don't know how this worked. And in hindsight, I have no idea how this was possible. But we found out that if you held the record button down halfway, you could still slightly hear the recording below it, and then put a recording over top of it, thus being able to overdub. Right. So if you only half recorded it, then it would work. We also used to do stuff like record at a half speed, because it was the kind of tape machine that if you held down pause slightly while it was recording, it would slow the tape down. So we used to make ourselves sound like, you know, ghouls or robots or, you know, or chipmunks or that kind of shit, right? so that was some of my first recordings.
That is incredible. And I'm sure it's much easier to do that with a DAW, but there is something a little special about hacking your machine with a piece of duct tape and...
There's some things you can't do with the DAW too, like actually the Beatles were kind of famous for this, like doing a tape flanging when they'd recorded two machines at the same time and play them back at the same time, and then there's slight inaccuracies of the motor, because the motor can only roll the tape, you know, so perfectly, because it's just a machine. The sound of those two sounds rubbing against one another, being slightly in and out of time, is what created the sound of flanging, which is now, you know, you can buy a flanger pedal for your guitar or whatnot, but ultimately that was an effect that the Beatles established just to make their music sound trippier, so that way people on drugs could enjoy it too. and actually that's something that's very hard to do in a DAW. Another thing also, like I was saying, like putting your thumb on the tape to slow it down, or holding the pause button down so you slow it down and sort of screw it up, that's actually hard. It's hard to ruin a DAW recording. Like they tend to move along perfectly, recording the time in perfect time and not messing it up, right? So some of the ways you can distort and screw around with audio tape is actually very difficult to do in a DAW. In Pro Tools, you can record at halftime very easily. It'll play back at halftime, and then you can record your part very slowly and then play it back. But when you do that, the sound will be an octave higher than it was. It'll be like a chipmunk sound, right? So you have to play it all one octave lower for that to work. Actually, I play organ in a band called The Uptights, and right before we recorded our first record, the night before, I was hit by a car on my bicycle and broke my wrist, broke my right wrist and my left shoulder. So I really couldn't play the piano with a cast on, obviously. But I still went to studio the next day, because I'm committed. And I recorded all the other instruments, the bass, the drums, and the guitar. And then as my hand started to heal and I got my cast off, my hand was super stiff from all the scar tissue in my wrist. So what I would do is I'd go to physiotherapy and I'd have them like stretch my hand out and stretch my wrist out and help it get mobilized again as they do. And then I'd run back to the studio really quick and I'd track the organ solos an octave lower, playing at half speed because I wasn't as fast as I was anymore at ripping a solo. So I'd play it all at half speed, one octave lower, and then on the record it sounds normal like what I wrote, but because I only had half the dexterity as I had before the accident. Yeah, it's pretty crazy.
That is an awesome story of like working around a lot of different barriers.
Yeah, if you want to sing something super high too, like if you want to do, you'll hear that a lot in, you know, modern pop music or R&B, where there's like, you know, sort of Mariah Carey-esque vocals that are so high. So if you're not Mariah and you cannot sing like her, you can just do it where you record at half speed, sing it as your normal notes, and then let it play back super high, and you'll get an extra octave out of your own voice.
Join us every other Wednesday from 6:30 to 8 p.m. for Sam Squanch's Hideaway with your host, Anita B., as she plays all Canadian music with a focus on indie rock and pop.
Specific hack that I've always wanted to try, just like keeping up with the music industry, is one of the people I follow, Jeff plays guitar. All of his DAW data gets fed out and into some blown-out tube amps.
Oh, cool.
He intentionally wrecked some tube amps and then pumped it right back into a DAW amp.
Oh, that's an awesome idea. There's one studio in town that they wired up their tape machine. It gets a bit techie, this part of the conversation, but they wired up their tape machine. So coming right off of the record head or the playback head, it streams directly to Pro Tools. So you can record to tape, but immediately after it's been onto tape, 1 inch down the tape, there's the playback head, and that's taken and goes right into their DAW. So everything sounds like they recorded it to analog tape, but it's but you have the convenience of going directly into your DAW right away. So I do that sometimes too. I mean, around my studio, Rain City, I have a tape machine, but it's just a, you know, it's sort of a prosumer quality one, you could say. It's not like a big honking washing machine one, like a Studer or something. It's a Tascam 8-track half inch. And these machines sound really nice. They distort in a nice way. Like, they don't sound, aggressive or something. They sound nice and warm. And the tape is pretty cheap, too. You know, like, it's maybe $30 for a tape, and you can record that many times, you know, hundreds of times if you want. So it's just 8 tracks, but I was recording a record for this woman, Chance Lovett, and it's just meant to have more of a, you know, more of a soulful sort of 60s, you know, Motown-ish sound. And I took the recording I done for her digitally once it's all perfect, and then I crammed all that onto the tape machine, and then just ran it right back in for mixing just to give it that that color. I think that's so important these days as well. It's like, you know, any kind of music, you know, even a lot of modern pop music will have a lot of elements of retro color. There's always distortion on things that we want to have, just so things feel like they have character or that they pop out of the speaker in a different way. So, yeah, that's what your friend did. It's an awesome idea. Like, old tube amps, they distort so cool. So if you find one that you like and it's working for you, I mean, that could be your signature sound too, right? Like, there's so many people that have done that well. I have to think about like those Neutral Milk Hotel records. I'm not sure if you ever listened to them, but you know, they're so aggressive. Like, they're so blown out. Even though the music's so beautiful, you know, it's like such amazing songwriting. Jeff Magnum, I guess the guy. Yeah, I mean, obviously his tape machine was just calibrated like so hot. Like, I think I read a story about that guy in Tape Op. I think he was like painting houses for the summer, you know, or for a job, painting houses somewhere in the States. And he was painting a house for some old German guy or something. And the guy was like, "Hey, you're a musician, huh? You know, you're into music?" And he was like, "Yeah." And he's like, "I got a couple microphones you might be interested in." And, like, gave him a pair of, like, Neumann microphones from Germany, like, from, like, whatever, the 50s or something. And I think that's how he recorded those records. I think I remember reading that somewhere. But, yeah, you know. Yeah, whatever you got at your disposal, use that. It's not about... Like, you can throw money at sound quality, and you can get sound quality out of things, and in some capacity, that's important to me. Like for example, I told you I'm recording a jazz record in August. That's got a certain amount of fidelity. That's what's being expected, and what I'm being hired to do. You know, not everybody has to, you know, focus on every single type of recording that can be done. If You know, like if you're like Sufjan Stevens, for example, he's another guy who's like recorded everything through a 58. Like those records sound so beautiful and so clear, and it's all through a 57 and a 58 and a little Mackie mixer. Like he's, again, he's just such a good songwriter and singer and a music arranger. Like it's just, it's actually his production that makes it clear, not the money through the microphone. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, those albums are definitely like standouts in my memory. I remember Neutral Milk Hotel, I got into them in high school. Yeah. And just the difference of sound that they had compared to, like, I had been listening to Said the Whale and like a lot of Vancouver-based but more modern-sounding bands.
Clear poppy. Yeah.
Incredible.
Yeah,
very,
for sure.
Very formational for me. But hearing that and like, it just twigged in my memories, like listening to vinyls with my dad.
It gives you that nostalgic feeling. Actually, there's a funny, there's a plugin I got recently for Pro Tools. It's made by this company called Goodhertz, and the plugin is called Tupe, T-U-P-E. It's tubes and tape combined, and into one plugin. So it's basically a distortion plugin or a saturation plugin with some EQ and some filtering and various things to kind of manipulate how it sounds. But they have in the plugin, they have a bunch of presets that the designer of the plugin had. A design that has, you know, in their opinion, the distortion characteristics of certain records. Like, for example, there might be, Aretha Franklin, like Respect, or there might be one that kind of feels more like 80s, like, Fleetwood, or maybe 70s, like Fleetwood Mac Rumors might be trying to re-represent the certain sort of timbre in the plugin. But one of the presets is the Neutral Milk Hotel preset. I couldn't believe it because it's like, you wonder. I don't know. It's hard. I know they're a huge cult classic now band, right? But you wonder, oh, are these software nerds writing this code? Of course, they're all music nerds too. That's why you would get into doing that kind of detailed work. But yeah, he emulated the Neutral Milk Hotel sound, and I was working on a mix, and I purchased the plugin or I downloaded the plugin or something. And I put it on the mix I was working on, which was a band that didn't even necessarily sound like Neutral Milk Hotel to me. It was just like, whatever, some rock band, say all I was working on, who knows what it was. And I put it on, and I was like, oh my God, it does sound like that. Like, the way the low end is distorting and all blown out and sounds like powerful but not harsh or something. Like, there's a characteristic to that particular record that's In the Airplane Over the Sea. And I swear to God, I put it on, I was like, holy cow, it really sounds like that record. It's neat. So that's a cool plug-in to demo. If anybody wants to do some blown-out folk rock music, that's one to check out. And also, the plug-in sounds so great on other things, too. Sounds really great on bass guitar. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. What do you recommend for people to start in music recording and engineering?
Well, I mean, I guess it depends what platform you're on. I don't know what's available for freeware on the PC side of things so well. I'm just more of a Mac user. But Mac comes free with GarageBand. So, GarageBand, if you own a Mac and you have that program, which I'm pretty sure is free whenever you have that computer, then I think try that, you know. And if you get into it, like, if you get to the point where you start feeling limited, well, then you learn something else. But, you know, and I'm sure Apple would love for you to learn Logic, so you could give them more money for that. But there's lots of free programs as well. And any of them are fine. They're all the same. The one that's the best is the one you know, the one that you're comfortable working with. Because, you know, using a computer can be sort of tedious and annoying. And I find that DAWs are pretty complicated programs, and there's a bit of an uphill learning curve. So for the first month, like, you know, if you have some music that you've written and you wish to record yourself, for example, for that first month, you might just feel like, you know, it's annoying, or that, you know, maybe it's hampering your spontaneity or creativity having to kind of interface with the computer. But then eventually that'll become second nature to you. And I think the trick to any of these programs are, I mean, same with any computer program, but the trick is learn the keyboard shortcuts. Like, I know in Pro Tools, like, if you go to the edit menu to do an editing function, there's always it always tells you what the keyboard shortcut for that is beside it. So if you find yourself going up there more than once a day, you know, learn it. And then next thing you know, you'll feel like the DAW is more of an extension of your hands or your body. And you can work much more quickly. And then it'll stop getting in the way of your creativity. I mean, that could be generational as well, because I didn't really grow up using computers much just because I'm in my mid-40s. I mean, I didn't. Like, I went through high school without using a computer, if you can believe it. We had one in the house. My dad had a computer and stuff, but I just thought it was boring. I thought playing music was way cooler than using a computer. Then all of a sudden, those things became the same for me when I was maybe like 19 or 20. So I all of a sudden had to learn one. And the DAW I used. I'd use some WaveLab or maybe some Steinberg programs on PC on my dad's computer just to kind of capture my 4-track recordings and make them available print a CD or maybe turn it into MP3. But yeah, shortly after that, like I said, I got Pro Tools, and yeah, for the first month, I kind of felt like I was I'd be sweating when I was using it, you know. But now I'm sweating when I'm not using it. You know, I feel like I'm stressed out when it's not available to me because it's so easy for me. So, So I would say, you know, the best program is whichever one is easy and available to you. They all have some features that the other ones do not, and people that compose a lot with MIDI, Pro Tools is maybe not their favorite. But I'm sure if you learn the heck out of the MIDI on Pro Tools, you'd probably love it too. So who knows? But I don't do a ton of MIDI composition. I do it just casually for virtual instruments and stuff like that. So
yeah, I definitely am well aware of having to learn keyboard shortcuts from working on Audacity and all that.
Oh, you use Audacity for your program? Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It's running right now.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it's available. It's there, and all the programs, you know, they take the same plugins, either VSTs or audio unit plugins, and if computers could have a soul, the soul is in the plugins. That's, you know, the recording is just the recording. The computer is just the platform to get the tracks down. But the plugins are where, you know, you find your character and you find your fun. And that's where it sort of becomes more of an art form and less of a technology you have to, navigate. So, yeah, I have a ton of analog gear, and I even have an analog mixer too. At Rain City, we have an Eve mixing console, but I still mix really heavily in Pro Tools with a lot of plugins, and I love them. I mean, some of them I just couldn't get my sound without them.
You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam speaking Musqueam people. Nisiam Nisiaya, Thikum Queen Ansep, Hydra CM, Nisiam
Nisiaya, Anthasiakuya, Talitin, Homasqueam, Mustail. What's your absolute favorite plugin then? Like, what's the one you go to absolute first?
The plugin I use the most is probably, the plugin that I just would not want to mix without for me is a plugin called Auto Align, SoundRadix Auto Align. And this is a very geeky plugin. It's not a very artsy kind of plugin, but it is, Auto Align is a plugin that you put one instance of it on one channel. Like so what you do is you use it on an instrument that has two mics on it. Or for example, like a lot of the time when people record electric bass, they'll have a DI from the bass, and then they'll have a microphone on the bass speaker to get a little bit of character out of the player's, you know, bass amplifier. But the problem with that is that those two signals arrive slightly out of time, because the sound that came out of the speaker had to pass through a little bit of air, which took a millisecond or so to get to the microphone, whereas the sound that came off of the DI box right off the pickup of the bass, that came in much quicker. It came in more or less at the speed of light. So by those two signals not being perfectly in time, when you combine them, they slightly cancel. They might get a little bit louder, but then other parts, like some frequencies might get louder and other frequencies get a little bit quieter. That's called phase cancellation. And you can try to adjust that by flipping the polarity button, like any DAW or almost any EQ plugin or almost any mixer or mic preamp almost always have a polarity button. So you can flip that polarity button and see which way those two signals sound better, because sometimes inverting the polarity will make the low end sound better on the bass, maybe. But maybe flipping it the other way might make the low end sound worse, but it might make the mid-range sound better. So auto-align takes that guesswork out. What it does is it takes the two signals, it looks at where they are in time, and it automatically slides one back or forwards or backwards in time, so that that way they are in time as much as they could possibly be. So in this case, the microphone signal, the DI signal, it would always delay that just slightly, not to the point that you could hear your performance being late, but just by a few milliseconds or microseconds or something, picoseconds, who knows. And it'll line them up so that the two are as in phase as they can be. And that immediately, to me, makes the bass guitar sound so much clearer and fuller. The low end feels tight and full, and the high end still clear. And I use that on a lot of instruments. Like, I'll use it on, I often put two mics on a snare, one above and one below. It'll align those to make them in time. I often use two mics on the kick drum, often one inside to get like a little bit of beater attack and one outside for a more natural or kind of like old school sound. And it'll align those two. And once it takes a few milliseconds for it to think about it, you sort of hit capture on the two plugins and then play back in your DAW. And then it combines, and it just sounds so much better to me immediately. Sometimes if you have a stereo recording too, like if you have two overhead mics on a drum kit, aligning them can all of a sudden you'll feel like you're a snare drum, or whatever drum is below the mics just feels so much more in focus. So even though it's not a very creative plugin, it's not even a plugin that I do anything. It does all the work. I just hit go and it figures it out for me. But for me, that's like the one that I just I don't want to live without. There is a free version of it. The free version is you play back your two tracks at a time and you slide one of them back and forth until you think it sounds better. Or in the case of Pro Tools, you can do a nudge, which is done with the period and the comma keys. And you can set the nudge to be one sample of audio, so it's the finest resolution. It'll nudge back and forth. And you can nudge back and forth until you hear the same effects. And you might get to that same results, but sometimes it feels like you don't know which one's better at some point in time. All of a sudden it's like, oh, this way the low end's a little bit better, this way the high end's a little bit better. It becomes hard to kind of judge. And this program just figures it out for you. So I like that. And yeah, but that's one. And then, there's some sort of subscription ones too that I really like, and some freeware ones too. I've been using the UAD subscription plugins recently, which they cost some money. They're like $15 a month. But they for doing kind of vintage sounding music, like alternative rock or indie rock or punk rock or hip hop, or anything that's supposed to have any kind of a vintage character, like they sound pretty awesome. Yeah, so those are kind of my favorites right now.
All right. It's cool that that's not like a super niche or specific plugin, because we're here to find out about sound and how to make good sound, the sound of the Pacific Northwest.
Yeah. I think this also, like, Pacific Northwest sound, like, there, I think there is a sound that Vancouver and Seattle and other cities like that have in it, Victoria too. Like, there is there's always been kind of a rich character to the music of this area, and I think there's a couple of different sounds. I mean, I guess when I, it's funny, like when I kind of think of it, I'll often think of the bands in our local music scene that I like, and they've always been bands that have had, pretty comfortable use of effects, lots of distortions and reverbs and delays are common. And I mean, there's been a lot of scenes over the years, like obviously for me growing up in the 90s, the Seattle music scene, which also spilled into Vancouver, was a massive influence. And those recordings are, really still well revered now. I mean, especially Nirvana, obviously, or Pearl Jam or Soundgarden, that kind of stuff. Those records still, they were very cutting edge sounding at the time. I mean, so much so they almost really dethroned what was popular before them, because, you know, prior to that, you know, the grunge movement and that sort of punk becoming mainstream in the 1990s. Prior to that, you know, rock music on the radio would have been more like the tail end of like 80s glam rock, you know, Poison and Motley Crue and stuff like that. But those bands all recorded in Vancouver too. You know, Vancouver was really the recording mecca. You know, like studios in Vancouver recorded Aerosmith and AC/DC and Motley Crue and all that, you know. Obviously, Bryan Adams is huge, always has been. But, like, so Vancouver's had a huge influence in the sound of records all over the world. I feel like Vancouver was almost more known for that in the late 80s and early 90s, and then Seattle maybe sort of dethroned it for some time in the 90s. But I also, like, I operate a lot in the, like I was saying, and, you know, in punk and hardcore and some metal too and stuff like that. And I know a lot of bands from this town are kind of revered for having, you know, cutting edge or particularly crazy sounding recordings, some of which I like to think I was able to be a part of, and some bands from other cities have reached out to me for mixing because of that. Like, I've actually done a lot of bands from Europe, a lot of bands from South America too. Vancouver bands are well known in Colombia, Argentina. You know, I've even had a band from Peru reach out to me before, and, you know, saying like, hey, can you mix our record? Like, you know, we recorded it all at a local studio, but we want to have a bit of that Vancouver sound, you know. So I'm always so proud when that's the case. I'll almost put everything aside to participate in like a record like that, because I just think it's amazing that bands from our little scene get out there, you know.
TransCare BC works to enhance the coordination of trans health services across the province and offer expanded health services to support transgender communities. They are doing this by developing gender-affirming client-centered models of service, ensuring access to gender-affirming and supportive healthcare that is equitable and available, and supporting network development to make sure trans and gender-diverse individuals, their families, and healthcare providers have access to information, resources, and support. Check out phsa.ca to learn more about this program and lend your voice to help create an inclusive and supportive system for trans members of our community.
Yeah, I definitely grew up in the midst of the, like, late punk, early grunge movement. Mm-hmm. Nirvana, Soundgarden, and, like, yeah. Those, that era mm-hmm. defined me. And then my babysitter's oldest son was really into Riot Girl.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I love it. Yeah. Can you so, Kill and...
Sleater-Kinney.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, Bratmobile was another one that's pretty rad, and Team Dresch, they were another rad. I think they were Olympia band as well. That was like rad, all girl or all femme punk band that just ruled. That's a scene that I totally love and admire. Have you seen The Punk Singer?
No.
The Punk Singer is the documentary about Kathleen Hanna from Bikini Kill.
Okay, yeah, okay.
You should watch it. It's inspiring.
Definitely going on the list.
Yeah, the footage of Bikini Kill rocking it out in, like, whatever, 93 or something. You wish you were in the mosh pit then.
I really, really do.
Yeah. She's so rad. Yeah, great movie.
My first ever mosh pit was Cancer Bats.
Yeah.
Concert back in 2006, 2007.
Nice.
It was at my old middle school.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Cool.
They had a big theater, and it got destroyed.
Wow.
It was so much fun.
Cancer Bats played your high school.
Middle school.
Oh,
all things. They played at
my
middle school.
Oh, my God. What middle school is that?
That was Spencer Middle School out in Lankford, middle of nowhere.
Nice. I can't believe it. That's amazing. Well, they just toured now. They came and played the Rickshaw recently, I know, so... That's great.
Yeah, it was a couple of bands as well, from, like, punk bands from Victoria and, like, metal.
Yeah.
Blew my mind.
That's amazing. Yeah. That's great. Well, that's good. Yeah. Young people's minds need to be blown from time to time.
Oh, absolutely.
Steers you on the right course.
It's been a few years since I've been in a mosh, though.
Yeah, I don't tend to mosh too much these days. Yeah. I'm more in the crowd these days, mingling, or avoiding mingling most of the time these days. Yeah.
Yeah, I my body definitely can't take much more moshing like it did in middle school.
Totally.
I'm not.
Oh, that's great. Well, I'm glad. It seems like a lot of the shows. I saw some. I didn't go to Cancer Bats and Misery Signals that when they came and played Rickshaw recently, but I saw some videos from it online, and it looked like there was plenty of people to take your place. So.
They're not slowing down, and it's been a minute since they've been around.
Yeah, no doubt.
What was your first ever like live concert you got to go to?
Well, I mean, I saw some bigger concerts as a child. You know, like my parents took me Expo 86. I saw Jerry Lee Lewis and Fats Domino, double bill. So two of the rock and roll piano greats. I was a piano player as a kid. I still am. So my dad took me to see those. And my mom. But the first kind of, you know, and I saw a couple of big glam rock shows too, just because I loved glam rock music as an early age. I saw Motley Crue on the Dr. Feelgood tour, and I saw Metallica and Poison and stuff like that. But the first there's a couple of, I saw the Red Hot Chili Peppers just before they kind of blew up, with a I don't know if they're really a riot girl, but definitely a female or femme hardcore band called 7 Year Bitch. They're a band from Seattle. Yes. Yeah, it was Red Hot Chili Peppers and 7 Year Bitch at the P&E Forum. Mm-hmm. So that's like still pretty big, you know, a couple thousand people, but not like Coliseum big. But that was, I saw that in grade 7, and that was still the craziest mosh pit I've ever seen. It was, there may have been two layers of people, you know, it was just like, it was 1991 or something, it was just insane. But the first kind of like, you know, kind of like touring band that I saw that was more popular on an underground level was Fugazi. I saw Fugazi in 93 with Spark Marker and Mechanormal, who are still a great local band that play once in a while. Gene Smith, also a cool painter. But yeah, they played a pretty big outdoor festival, Plaza of Nations. They used to do shows down there. And that was a really formative show for me. Like, I met a lot of the friends that I would have throughout my high school years and to this day at that show. That's the first time I went to like a big hardcore show, you know, with like really like, or like a show with any kind of community. Like, there, you know, Fugazi is a very political band, you know, in those days, or so they still would be if they were still a band. Like, you know, the shows were always $6, always all ages, period. They did not play bar shows. Like, it was meant to be accessible to everyone. Also, you know, Spark Marker as well, a very political band. Definitely a feminist band, definitely gay rights, LGBTQ rights was an important part of their politics as a band, as Fugazi's would have been. So that show for me was very formative in kind of discovering a DIY community, or like an underground Vancouver, like local music scene community. And at that show, I was also soliciting my band's first show ever. I was promoting an all ages show that was happening just a week or two after that show. So I was handing out flyers. I printed out hundreds of flyers and I was handing them to everybody I know and talking to everybody too. And so many people ended up coming to see my band play. And a lot of those people became my friends, you know, and people that I, you know, made music with or recorded or did shows with or whatever for years, even still now. So that feels like a formative show. It was the 30-year anniversary of that show I played just a few nights ago, which made me feel very old, but I still feel young, but definitely old, I still feel young. But yeah, so that was a big one for me. And there's another band that played in the local rec center called Brand New Unit. And actually, sadly, the singer of that band just died recently, which is really sad. Gary from Brand New Unit died, which is really, really unfortunate for his friends and family and everything. But yeah, they were a band that I saw live at my local community center in North Vancouver, where I grew up, the Lonsdale Rec Center, which we called the South Wall. That was our little community center. And they played, and you know, I'd heard Green Day at this point, and I'd heard Descendants and other pop punk bands that I liked. But I saw them, and I was like, oh man, I'm like, that's that's the sound I relate to, you know, like it's melodic, but still punk rock, and it feels, you know, feels aggressive and threatening and energetic, but also sort of positive in a way too, you know, it doesn't feel like a negative aggression. It's almost kind of more like, you know, getting your negative feelings out or something, you know, in a way, right? Like, I think maybe if you're not hurting someone else, moshing or that kind of thing can be a positive thing to participate in, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, as long as you're not, you know, hurting someone else. That's something actually Fugazi was always very political about. They actually had like a no moshing rule at their shows because they didn't want people that were, you know, smaller than other people or you know, particular women or just maybe people with different disabilities or what have you, to not be able to enjoy the show close up. So they used to always put a stop to that. Maybe there's a middle ground to be found too. Who knows? But I won't be the one to judge.
Moshing on the left.
Yeah, it could be that. Exactly. Yeah,
it's
exactly.
A little fence down the middle there.
You want an elbow on the face? Go over here. Yeah. You don't want an elbow on the face? Go over there.
Exactly.
There's probably a middle ground to be found, but that's what's... That's politics. That's everything. It evolves. It doesn't stay stagnant. There's not one right or wrong principle in some things. Sometimes you have to kind of try different things and see what works. These days it feels like people get a little wilder at shows than they did back in those days, funnily enough. But, you know, I also think people probably got a lot of bottled up, energy inside of them after having a boring ass couple of years. So maybe they gotta let that out too. I don't know.
I mean, if there's any place to get a release, it's through music and through like concerts.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, as long as you're not invading someone's space in a way that's making taking away their ability to enjoy themselves, then it's probably okay. But who knows?
Ends at the tips of your toes.
Yeah, exactly. Good call.
So you talked briefly about your first concert. I want to hear all about that.
Yeah. My band's first concert? I was in a band called DBS. We played live here on CITR in 1993. Evan Simons was the DJ at that time, well, along with probably Nardwar. We were interviewed by Nardwar on CITR, actually. Evan Simons and you know, later Ben Lai did so many live recordings of bands on CITR, which I think is so fun, live from Thunderbird Radio Hell. And we got to play it, it was in the summertime, I remember. It was like August, maybe. We just finished recording our first record at a cool studio on Commercial Drive, which later on I ended up renting out a portion of to be my studio, a place called Profile Studios, run by Cecil English. And CITR asked us to come and play live on the radio, and we played for an hour straight, no talking, no breaks. And I still have that recording, actually. When I came back to CITR for some other reason, maybe to play live again in a different band, someone had found a box of the tapes of the recording, and they gave it to me, which was so nice of them to set it aside for me. I'm not sure if it was Evan or maybe Ben or someone had set that aside for me, but it was really kind of them to do so. And I have it, and I've since digitized it and even put it on our Bandcamp and stuff like that. So, we played our first show, and I was doing the live sound as well. So. And that's another thing that relates back to recording as well. If you have an opportunity to do some live sound, it's the same. You know, it's got the same principles apply. There's different skills in recording and live sound, but, you know, you don't get worse at one from doing the other, that's for sure. It's all microphones and mixers and stuff. I did the live sound, and I made it just $2 for the show, you know, and like Fugazi, $6, and I guess we're two, you know. It was great. All our friends from high school came, and you know, and lots of people I'd met at the Fugazi show and stuff came, and we just had the best night a ninth grader ever had. It was super fun. So actually, there's the guys in my band were in eighth grade, and that really kind of for me that started off my involvement in doing live music and recording local bands all the time. And there was a couple other bands that I was fortunate enough to kind of meet through putting on these shows. there's a band that's, you know, also really was really revered called Submission Hold. Previously, they were called Insult to Injury. But they were a band of kind of real anarchist punks. Jen Danger was the name of the singer. She was like a classical singer that had become like a punk rock singer and just had so much range in her voice. Like, she's unbelievable. I'm not sure if their stuff has kind of ever made it to the streaming platform, Spotify or whatever. I should look. But at the time, they were one of Vancouver's best bands. They toured Europe many times and stuff. And my first kind of paid recording was recording them in their basement. They had an iconic punk house on First and Victoria around that area called the First Street House and Fish and Old House. And I recorded the album in their basement. And it was actually interesting because I had the 4-track, so I recorded it. And then James Farwell from Bison and Streets, he had the 2-track. He was going to recording school and had borrowed a DAT machine to mix down on, a digital tape machine. And Steve McBean from Black Mountain had the mixing board. So the three of us all shared different pieces of equipment. And I was maybe 15 at that time. And they paid me all in candy and a 6-pack of beer. So a bunch of chocolate bars and 6 beers or something. So that was like my wage for recording it. I spent the whole weekend recording it, and it was awesome. And that came out on 7-inch, which is, you know, pretty cool at that time for me to have a cassette recording pressed to vinyl. That was pretty special. Yeah, I remember later that night, my parents came and picked me up. They would drive me over to East Van in their white SUV and drop me off to record the East Van punks, you know, and stay over for the weekend. You know? Super hilarious. So I was like a suburban kid, right? And then after the recording, I got picked up and I went down to Seattle and we opened for 7 Seconds, which was a great punk band too. So we got to play with them that night too. So it was a pretty exciting weekend.
Sounds like.
Yeah.
All right, so we are coming up on the end of this episode. Mm-hmm. Any wrapping up notes? How do people find you and how do people reach out?
Well, people find me. I mean, I have a website, jessegander.com, and my studio, Rain City Recorders, is called raincityrecorders.com. So that's all easy to find there. And I have regular social media channels. I'm not a heavy user of social media, but I'm active on there, and I certainly return my DMs. On Facebook and Instagram and all that kind of stuff. My name is always my name. I don't operate under any aliases or anything like that on social media. I think maybe just like if there's anything I want to portray is that to people that wish to record themselves or other people in particular, as I do, is just do it. Use whatever you have. Don't worry about the money. Don't worry about the cost. If you got to steal some software first, steal some software and then record with it. And then if you make some money, pay for it later on. You know, that's the right thing to do. Or use a free program, then you don't have to steal. Also, if you want to be a recording engineer, if you're going to recording school and that kind of thing, you will never, ever build a career for yourself if you not build a community around yourself. You need to go to your band's shows. You need to make friends with them. It doesn't mean you have to solicit people at their shows, but you have to support them. Mm-hmm. You have to talk to them. You have to make friends with people. Do live sound, or maybe like ask a band, if there's a local band you love and you love to work on their music, ask if you could come and record them onto your DAW for free. Like maybe bring an 8-channel interface to their next gig and ask, hey, can I do a little live recording for you? And most of the time they're going to say, yeah, that'd be cool. And then you can spend a month of your own time sweating over it and trying to mix it down and make it not sound bad. And then you can give it to them. And maybe they'll be stoked and they'll post it online. And then maybe someone else will be like, hey, will you do that for our band? We want to do a live demo. Or maybe that band will be like, hey, we actually love what you did for us live. We'd like to have you record our record or our 7-inch or our EP or whatever. So you have to make yourself seen. You have to make yourself known. Mm-hmm. No amount of education, no amount of investment in new equipment is ever going to build you a career. You need to build a community around yourself. So, yeah, go see local music. Go support your local friends. You know, you don't have to work for free for your whole life. You can make a career in the recording arts, but you need to put a little bit of time in to get your name out there. And mixing and recording is so difficult to do at a very high level that the more you do it, the better you become. And, you know, there's so many online forums and, you know, YouTube and stuff like that, and great books you can read about it. There's so much education you can have for free. Or if you choose to, you can choose to go the formal route and get a formal education. I mean, myself, I'm self-taught. And I, as I sort of described in some of these, you know, early formative shows that I went to and stuff, that became how I built the community that supported me. And when I started charging money, even a small amount, like I started charging $10 an hour, or, you know, or something real cheap like that. That was like minimum wage back then. And people were willing to pay me a little bit for that. And now I'm at a level where people will pay me a lot more to do it because they want to try to make something that sounds top notch. But there's room for all styles of recording. There's room for all price points of recording, you know. So, yeah, record a couple of bands for free. And if you love the work and you love doing it, then you're going to want to pursue the knowledge one way or another, whether it be formal or otherwise, to do it better. And then you will... And then you will make great recordings and people will be interested in what you do. And, yeah, if you mix something that sounds exciting and fun or original, or maybe it sounds even cliche in a way that some people might want. Some people want to sound cliche, too. Whatever it is, but you try to do that. And also I think that beyond that, the important thing is that you be nice to the people you're recording. Like, you know, make people feel good. Artists are insecure. You know, Rain City is a place where we record people of all walks of life. You know, it's everyone is welcome, all skill levels, you know, and obviously all people of all, you know, ethnicities, whatever gender diversities, whatever it might be. Everybody, you know, we all get treated the same. And that doesn't mean that we approach every project the same, because some people need something different than other people. But if you come in and you're insecure, then I'm going to try to hold your hand, help you out, get comfortable and record it well. And if you come in there really confident and you want me to really criticize the living heck out of you and get the very best you can do, then I'm happy to do that too. And that's something that's really easy for us to talk about or try to, you know, judge in people too. Like what does this person need? Do they just need to find themselves and be themselves and express themselves that way? Or do they need to be pushed to be something even better? And if you can sense that in people, then you can record anybody. And that's what's, you know, that's just it. It's a service-based industry first and foremost, and making people happy and comfortable when you're working with them will mean that they can make their art better and their music better, and then they're more likely to come back to you for multiple recording sessions, and then you have more clients and you have more work, and people will be like, people have told me before, like, I like to record my vocals with Jesse because, you know, I'm just comfortable singing in front of him, you know, and that can be hard. That can be hard to do. So that's what I try to do. And because I've been a singer and I'm not the greatest singer, you know, by any stretch of the imagination, but I know the challenges that make people feel insecure when they're recording. And I do my very best to take that out of the equation when those people are singing. Unless they say, Jesse, I want you to beat me down. Just criticize every single note. And they sometimes do. Yeah. And then I'm happy to be like, okay, I will literally criticize every consonant you've ever sang. But only if you ask me.
Of course.
It doesn't have to be that kind of record. You know, it can be live and off the floor and cool and, you know.
And sometimes you just need to make music.
So, yeah, sometimes it's cool to be weird. Yeah. You know? Usually it's cool to be weird. Like Neutral Milk Hotel. It's just, it's not about it being in tune or perfectly clear in time. It's crazy, and why it sounds so good is because the emotion is so strong.
That's why we're Pacific Noise Weird.
You Pacific Noise Weird?
Got to be weird.
Got to keep it weird, yeah. And but if someone wants to pay some money, you can keep it normal for them too. Because it's a job.
It's their money.
Yeah, I'll make your record as normal as you want if you pay me.
All right, thank you so much for coming on today.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed the interview.
Yeah, this was great.
Yeah, I'm so glad there's a show about this.
All right, thank you very much, Weirdos. I'll see you next week. Thank you to all you beautiful weirdos out there in the wilds of the Pacific Northwest making noise, making you all of our problems. This wouldn't be the same without you. You can catch this episode as a podcast on CITR 109FM's website under the same name, and I'll be right back at you in a week. Same place, same time, so don't touch that dial. I've been your host, Coraline, and I am signing off for this week. Until next time, you are now exiting Pacific Noise Weird.